Hello, Simon Price here with another in our series of Three Spouse Singers podcasts. Our guest this week is no stranger to the choir and the wider musical community of Cornwall because it's Paul Como. He's now sitting at his piano in his home in Truro, ready to talk to us. Welcome, Paul.
Hello, Simon. Very pleased to be invited to do this. Just to prove the piano's here.
Oh, good, good, good. Okay, right, Paul, your association with Three Spires goes back a long way. Not only have you accompanied the choir at its weekly rehearsals, but you've also played in our concerts as a soloist, as well as on harpsichord and chamber organ continuo and so on in the orchestra. And you've also written music for performance by us and by choirs elsewhere in the country. When did you first join Three Spires Singers and how did it come about?
Well, very interesting, really. I'd finished school, university. I was in a not particularly good place. I think moving from the world of education to the world of work is a tricky one. But I hadn't been back in Cornwall for very long before I was invited to come along and play for Three Spires. So I turned up one...
Which year was that?
This was 1983.
83, yeah.
Yes, and I walked in and they were rehearsing actually the Monteverdi Vespers. I think I was late because I'd gone to the wrong building or something. and I was really struck by the sound because I'd had experience of singing in and listening to auditioned and non-auditioned choirs, and I had a pretty good idea of what I liked and what I didn't. And there was an awful lot of this as I seemed very lively and well-rehearsed and energetic.
Where were the rehearsals in those days, by the way? They weren't at Archbishop Benson, were they?
School. It was a rather curious arrangement where I think the festival, Three Spires Festival organiser, Albert Sinfield, had wanted to do something quite ambitious, get a lot of people down from London, you know, things like, for example, Nigel Kennedy playing the violin concert with the BSO. The downside of that is there's this complicated chain of command. You've got Richard Hickox, Paul Daniel, Martin Hall and myself that was involved. And in the end, I think it was a rather expensive, ambitious undertaking. The biggest change, I would say, came in 1990 when David Briggs took over. And from then onwards, it was really more a Cornwall-based thing. He got a very nice local orchestra together. And I'm of the view that on the whole that diversity is a good thing and that we should have people down, but we should also foster the best of local talent and ability. And I think 1990 onwards, I've had a great time. I've been involved in so many ways.
Well, I've calculated that you must have been, since 1983, you must have been involved in something between 130 and 140 Three Spires concerts. Which is quite something. Did Camilla join at the same time?
No, she turned up a bit late, in 1987. And in those days, I used to accompany warm-ups. And the reason she noticed me is that she always loved harmony and different chords and so on. And she said, oh, hang on a minute, there's this guy, a bit self-effacing, but every time there's a scale, he does a different harmonisation. And she was most interested in that because we had this in common, you see. This is going back to childhood, primary school in Berkshire, and we often had to sing, perhaps move around to music. And there was this old battle axe of a teacher that most people didn't like. I actually did. And the battle axe of the teacher was the person at the piano. And I thought, I don't want to be doing this singing, dancing. I want to be doing that job. That looks far more interesting. And equally, when I was about six, I could sing tunes, but I could hear this whole world going on underneath, and I was just dying to sort it out. I thought it was probably very complicated. It would take me years to decode it, but it was an absolute fascination for me. And another thing that stimulated me was my parents. I came from an art background, really. They were trained in fine art, the Slade, that sort of thing. But my father had this enormous interest in classical repertoire of all kinds, anything from, I don't know, Renaissance, Byrd, right through to Bartok and Shostakovich and beyond. I didn't like all of it, but there was so much going on that I actually developed a deep love and interest in it, and that's probably why I went in the direction I did. At the age of 11, I did actually have access to a piano, and then we moved down to Cornwall. At the age of 12, I had one of my own, and I can remember the age of 11, hearing things like the Beethoven Emperor Concerto. I've just got a piano. The first phrase is... But that... It took me about 5 minutes to get my hand round that eight-note chord, but this sense of satisfaction was just enormous, you know.
Now, you've taken the solo spot in some of our concerts, haven't you, playing the piano in the cathedral? Tell us a bit about those.
I did get the chance to play the Cornwall Youth Orchestra, and I ended up doing piano things as well. But I got there age 12 or something, and I had these 14-year-olds doing things like the Schumann Concerto, and I thought, my God, I'd love to do that, but I'm never, ever going to be good enough, you know, but I'd work at it. And it was like a sort of dream come true, really, to be invited by, well, actually orchestras in Penzance first. But so I was so pleased to be asked by Chris to do a concerto. I'd done other ones before. And he thought a Mozart concerto would go well.
That was number 20, wasn't it, Paul?
Yes, indeed. And what I particularly like about this is that it's so turbulent, sort of almost disturbing, dark beginning. I'll play it to you. Now, what a lot of people think about Mozart, they think that's Anaklanda music or... all frills and frothiness and wigs. But this shows really, you've got the French Revolution sort of in the pipeline, things with this, you've got this disturbing thing which is as syncopated as you can get. I just think it's a wonderful, wonderful concerto. And indeed, Mozart's father, Leopold, said, you know, goodness, this is the best thing you've ever written. This is just something quite extraordinary.
Which bit have you chosen that we should hear?
I would like to play the bit. It's the end of the orchestral introduction. The piano comes in very unassumingly. And then, before long, you'll hear the syncopated orchestral introduction, which I just played. But the piano will join the orchestra, so...
OK, you've chosen the Murray Pariah performance, so here goes. Well, your professional life has been very busy over the years, because of course you teach a great deal, don't you? You do classroom teaching and you have lots and lots of individual piano pupils.
I think where it's always come to life with me with individuals and small groups, I think. And but I've been very lucky because, as well as a lot of individual piano pupils, some of them very good actually. I've been in St Austell College, Truro High School, Truro School, various other places, usually in a part-time capacity. And sometimes I'm just invited in, perhaps to give a composition workshop, something like that.
Well, of course,
And
I knew you when you were at Truro School, when you were teaching a couple of days a week. Was it there?
yes, it was various part-time. Various lessons, and then that I used to put piano pupils back to back with that, which worked
Yeah.
quite.
Now, past students of yours tell me that you always had tricks up your sleeve if you thought the lesson was flagging. Tell us more, Paul.
You will find that when you get to advanced level music, there's a lot of technical term and clobber for harmony, the third inversion of the root position chord on the fifth notes of the dominant. And it's enough really to cause anybody to switch off. And so, if you're explaining one of these chords, I find it's quite handy to talk, say, something like the national anthem. First thing I tell them is I could actually be technically be imprisoned for what I'm going to do. Technically, there's a law that's never been repealed, which means
I
you can't
don't believe it.
wait for doing that. And then, when talking about one of these bizarre chords, the Neapolitan six, I'll say, well, I think if you put those in all over the place, that way you'd definitely be executed. And it'll be obvious, but in case you're not clear, it'll be the third chord I play.
I think you also had a special trick for enlightening them about what a coda is and how it can be used. Is that right?
Well, yes, because it's quite entertaining to do something like Happy Birthday, but as perhaps a famous composer might have improvised on it, and a really good person to take off is Beethoven, because Beethoven was known to get quite angry when he was asked to improvise on the spot. So you might find he did something turbulent in the minor key, but then he wouldn't let you go at the end. You'd have to sit while he made his point. So.
I think that could go on and on and on, couldn't
A coda is a concluding section, so if you don't know what
it?
one is, that's how to explain it.
The endless Beethoven
Yes.
coda. Yeah. Okay. Now, as well as your teaching in the classroom and with individual pupils at the piano, you always have a Monday evening commitment with us to accompany our rehearsals. Sometimes, Paul, you're called on to take the rehearsal on your own. And you have to sort of dash between the piano and the podium, so to speak. Isn't that incredibly difficult to do?
Well, I think the first time it happened was in the 80s when literally nobody turned up, and it was a question either the choir going home or me sort of stepping up. And I think I can say I was incredibly nervous doing it. And one thing this has done, it's taught me, it's built up my confidence hugely, and now I don't mind doing anything like that at short notice. No, it hasn't worried me too much. Basically enjoyed it. I wouldn't have want to have overall responsibility, but to carry
Well,
me.
we singers in the choir, we're certainly full of admiration for when you have to do that, and we're very, very grateful, as I'm sure Chris is. While you've been accompanying us on Monday nights over the last, I won't say how many years, have you had particular favourite pieces that you've enjoyed rehearsing?
So something that I think has meant a lot to me over the years, and that's Dream of Gerontius. I know we've done a lot of big works. I love the Verdi Requiem. I love them all. Britten's Full Requiem is fascinating. But there's something about Elgar and the way, he was exploring, pushing boundaries. I think composers like Wagner had caused, and Brahms indeed, had sort of caused quite a revolution in the way you would think. And it's something really you might call chromatic harmony. And the best thing way I can illustrate this, there's an interesting Brahms set of variations on the theme of Handel. That the theme of Handel is lovely, but it's very direct four square. Now, Brahms does all sorts of things, but this is the chromatic version. Some of the variations, but that's how far he stretches it. And then you get things, people like Wagner at the same time, at the end of Valkyrie, and finding these lovely ways of shifting into unconsciousness. Now, what we have is Elgar coming along with his wonderful gift for melody and an English sort of style of writing, but then you find some of these innovations will come up, say, in the prelude, and we have this wonderful Princeton. For example, if I could single out one bit, I'm going to play it the wrong way on purpose. Nothing wrong with that, but what he does is that he shifts it, so here. But one enjoyable thing for me, this may not come out, but if you have a big orchestral sound, you'll find something like this is written in a song. What I tend to do is enjoy filling it up to make it sound more like an orchestra. I won't continue because probably the distortion level would be too great, and it would be lovely to hear an excerpt from that now.
You've chosen the Barbaroli 1965 recording with the London Symphony Orchestra. It is a fantastic little bit. It's three or four minutes long. Let's listen to it. For me, that's the emotional intensity of that is just incredible. First, you've got all that anguish and fear that the dying man is gripped with, and then that powerful, optimistic crescendos in the second section here. Oh, it's wonderful, wonderful stuff. Can we talk now about your composing? I have
Yes.
here a recording of the choir of St. John's College, Cambridge, conducted by Three Spires' former director, Andrew Nessinger, of your piece called Lux Mundi, The Light of the World. Before I play it, can you tell us a bit about it?
I think Andrew had seen in my CV that I'd done certain things in terms of composition at university, and he asked me if I'd write something initially for Three Spires. That we're talking about October and for a performance in December. I find composition very difficult. I tend to shy away from it, but then when you're asked to do something, you do really try and rise to the challenge. Camilla was very helpful. We looked at all sorts of texts, and we found something by someone called Father Andrew, who's I was looking him up on the internet. Very interesting character, Anglican clergyman who is very concerned to work with poor and deprived people in the East End of London. And it's a bit, shall we say, high church, but it's about the sort of sadness and fragility of us on earth and this little baby. It begins, I think they're wonderful words, silence of silver stars, cold in their purity. For one thing, you have to be quite thick-skinned if you write anything that pushes boundaries, which I think my piece does in some ways. I made the great mistake when this was first performed on the radio of telling perhaps too many people, and you know when they didn't enjoy it because it happened to come just after a very gentle, unchallenging piece of John Rutter. So the two things you get just say, "Oh, Paul, I loved the one that came just before yours." And did the rest
Unfair.
of that composition of yours lead to any interesting new commissions? That's what they're when they're being nice, they don't like it. As I say, it starts unaccompanied, and of a silence of silver stars, cold in their purity. Now, a lot of people might have done. Nothing wrong with that at all, but what I'm effectively doing is what a lot of composers have done. I'm using different scales. Now, it's a pure historic accident that we think mainly in terms of major and minor in all sorts of ways. And a scale essentially is a ladder, but if instead of you've got a slightly different ladder, and if you go around the world, I'm sure to the Middle East, you'll get all sorts of ladders other than our conventional one. And to my mind, some of these notes, especially that sounds much more cold to me and dissident, and perhaps the hard life in the desert. And then you also get the sort of warmth of being brought into the stable at Bethlehem. And you'll hear some little harmonic twists. I've got the same tune, but I do some various things with the harmony. That's loneliness, and I wanted to give that a sort of lonely feel. So you've got the melody and this feeling of sort of emotions being tweaked in slightly unexpected directions.
Let's listen to an extract of this anyway, sung by the St. John's College, Cambridge.
Thank you.
Beautiful. Absolutely beautiful. That was just verses 1, 4, and 5. Just a lovely, lovely piece. Okay. Paul, do you have any new projects, composing or otherwise? We're all, I know we're very much locked down at the moment, but do you have plans for that lovely post-COVID world that we're all looking forward to?
I don't have any fixed ideas at the moment. I'm also very much looking forward to getting my piano back. At the moment, I'm on a little upright piano. I've got a nice Steinway grand, but it was basically clapped out. My piano tuner said, "Go for it, Paul. It's worth paying for this. You are paying a lot, but a new Steinway won't be as good as this." That is arriving back at the end of March. So I've prepared little things to try, all sorts of things to try out, and I'm very much looking forward to that.
We're recording on Zoom, and I'm not quite sure what the sound of your little upright that you're making do with at the moment was sound like. I hope it's not too honky-tonky, but anyway, we'll see. It's fascinating to hear you explain things with the piano, I must say. Okay, we've got time for one more piece of music. What's it going to be?
Well, I've chosen the slow movement, the second movement of Ravel's G major piano concerto. We were three spouses very much hoping to have Cordelia Williams to play this in the same concert that we're going to do here, Russell's Secular Requiem. That's being put on hold. It's an absolutely lovely piece, and I think you said that you didn't really know it. Am I correct in saying that?
Yes, I have to confess that before you told me about your music choice here, I didn't really know the piece. Perhaps I've always been prejudiced about this composer because he wrote my absolutely least favourite piece of music of all time. You might be able to guess what that is, but.
Well, I can, and I feel very sorry for the man because Bolero and the G major
That's the
concerto
one.
were relatively late in his composing career, and he had a progressive mental illness. His mind was as alert as anything, but things like actually writing and eventually speaking were very difficult for him. And this beautiful movement we're going to hear, he used to have a beautiful calligraphic hand. But the writing looks actually quite childish, you know, that he can only just control the pen.
Well, in spite of my being so rude about that piece, Bolero, I have in fact been playing the Ravel concerto a lot in the last couple of days in preparation for doing this podcast, and it's been an absolute revelation. The slow movement certainly is heartbreakingly sad from the very beginning, and I nearly fell off my chair when I heard that note. It's halfway through the slow movement where the music seems to make this sudden transition to sort of turn a corner. Do you know the bit I mean?
Yes, I've just found it, I think. We're in a sort of, this is where we are.
That's it, that's the one. I'd love our listeners to listen out for that particular falling note, that the interval when we hear
Is
it
it
in
up?
context. It's just wonderful. Well, here it is then. It's the first part, at least, of the slow movement. It's the recording by Marta Argerich in a live performance with the Royal Stockholm Philharmonic, conducted by Yuri Turmerkinov in 2009. Well, it's wonderful to think that sometime post-COVID, we're going to have Cordelia Williams, who's someone I know that you deeply admire, coming down to play with us again, and she's going to do that piece, the Ravel Concerto. Thank you so much, Paul, for taking the time to record this podcast and to be so thoughtful in the way you've contributed. I know you're extremely busy in spite of the lockdown, so thank you very, very much.
Not at all. Pleasure to be invited. Thank you, Simon.
Thank you, and bye for now. Until
Bye.
next time, goodbye,
See you.
everyone.